Hey, hey, welcome to the Get Over Yourself podcast highlight show. Oh, what fun, what a privilege, what an honor it is to dive into our treasure trove of content archives and make this recording of brief excerpts from interview shows over the last couple of years of the Get Over Yourself podcast. I'm going to give you a little bit of an intro, a tee up for each one, and then you can enjoy these wonderful guests. And this experience reminds me of what a privilege it is to be in this position as the host and being able to connect with all these wonderful people and learn so much. It's a constant education and eye-opening, mind-expanding experience to sit down with these experts in all different areas. And here we go, people. Enjoy this highlight show. We're going to do more and more of these, and the idea, I guess, is to inspire you to go back and listen to the full recording if you happen to miss it, or if you did listen to it on cue as listening to the show, subscribing every week. Hey, guess what? You get a little teaser and a little reminder of the great commentary that you enjoyed from the full-length recording. So here we go. So first and most certainly not least, my very first interview recording for the Get Over Yourself podcast with the amazing Dr. Peter Attia. And what a great guy. He's so busy, so prominent, but he was nice enough to devote some of his precious, valuable time to me starting out my own podcast. He was also very helpful to Mark Sisson and I when we were working on the Keto Reset Diet, welcoming us into his office to give the full detailed explanation about what this keto thing was many years ago when it was first starting out. And you're going to love this clip because he pretty much simplifies the whole question of how to eat healthy. And here's one of the most complex and highly educated people in the health scene who's done that extreme self-experimentation that he's so famous for, and he just lays it out there pretty simple. Here's a nice clip from Dr. Peter Attia, the first interview produced on the Get Over Yourself podcast, and still one of the most downloaded recordings of all time. So go listen to the full length show with Dr. Peter Attia, host of the Drive podcast.
Nutrition, exercise, sleep. Those three things would probably have the biggest impact on your physical health. And it's hard to say that somebody who's, you know, achieving 80% of their potential on each of those three isn't also achieving about, you know, 80% of their longevity potential. Hmm. Now, you know, the difference between the 80% and the 100% in terms of effort is significant. It is not a non-linear effort curve, nor is it a linear curve of you know, achieving a benefit. But a lot of this stuff you don't need a doctor for. I mean, sometimes a doctor is helpful to measure things, but for the most part, I think there's enough information out there for people to, you know, have a sense of what they should and shouldn't eat. And I think people tend to get confused about things that don't matter. So there's such an amazing, you know, I'm sure you're more familiar with this than me, but I try to not think about this stuff, but, you know, endless confusion about, oh my God, should I be eating a plant-based diet, or should I be eating a paleo diet, or should I be on a low-carb diet, or should I be on a this diet or that diet? I mean, we could talk about those things all day long, but it might be more interesting to look at what do all of those things have in common if they're being done correctly. And that's probably the element that one ought to think most about. So as silly as it sounds, just to say, like, what if I had a zero junk food diet, or a diet of don't eat anything that my great grandmother couldn't have eaten? I mean, something as simple as that, right?
Which number one bestseller right there. Yeah.
Yeah. Not the book I'd write. But something as simple as that would basically take virtually all sugar, refined carbohydrates, processed hydrogenated oils, and all the other bullshit that's, you know, highly permeant within our food system, and just take it away. Done. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, you could vacillate on whether you should have grass-fed beef or non-grass-fed beef or no beef at all, or this type of egg or that type of egg, or dairy or no dairy. I mean, those things are important to be sure, but they also probably on some level have different individual outcomes. But if you got rid of sugar, if you got rid of refined carbohydrates, if you got rid of hydrogenated oils and the products that they show up in, because you don't buy those things off the shelf, right? It's not like, I want some sugar, let me go to the shelf and get it. No, it's get rid of everything that those things exist in. And again, like this has been codified for decades. Like this isn't like some new insight. The insight is the importance of this. I think the insight is if you do this for long enough, it matters.
This clip is from my interview with L. Russ, author of the sensational new book, Confident as Fuck. And the book before that, The Paleo Thyroid Solution. Some of you know L as the hostess, sort of my shared hostess with the Primal Blueprint podcast. We each publish a show every week on that channel. I've been working with her for many years as part of the Primal Blueprint operation. And she took the opportunity of our interview to reveal something in public that she never has before about a severe disability that she's been suffering from with her arm function for many years. And it's a pretty heavy show. You're going to love the whole recording, but also this clip here where she talks about the inspirational story of Bethany Hamilton, the surfer who was attacked by a shark in Hawaii. So let's hear a little bit from L. Russ.
You know, it's an interesting thing, and I'll tell you why Bethany Hamilton, her story means so much to me. It's because when I was 22, 23, I was working in the corporate world in San Francisco, and I was making six figures, and I was killing it. I mean, nobody my age was, you know, rolling in that dough right out of college. And I was the seventh person hired at a company. I was promoted every couple of months. I was killing it. I'm there like a couple of years. And then my next promote, the company's exploding now. And we're, you know, this is like Y2K days. You know, there's so much work going on. And then I'm about to get promoted to a job where I'm going to be making $250,000 a year. And I'm like 23 years old. And I'm like, oh, and I can just see my whole life ahead of me. I'm like, oh, there's going to be like, whatever, five Porsches in the driveway. I'm going to have three homes. Like, I'm going to be so fully retired by the time I'm 40. Forget about it. Like, this is going to be great. And then one day my arms stopped working.
Just like that, huh?
Like, literally.
Speaking of, was that your transition from Bethany Hamilton to Elle's arm stops working?
To Elle's arm stops working. So, I literally stopped working. I couldn't wipe myself. I couldn't hold a fork in my hand.
Just one arm?
No, both arms, all the way from my hands and my shoulders. I had chronic tendonitis. It was so severe. I had to ice my arms several times a day. My arms were extremely inflamed. But I was making so much money for the company. They had to kind of keep me around because of my voice, of talking to people. I was hiring and, you know, account managing people in these big projects for Fortune 500 companies. And literally my arm stopped working and I'm 23 and, you know, I'm just dumb and young and I'm thinking, oh, well, I guess I'll just go to the doctor. They'll give me some, like, this will get fixed, right? Like, right? Wrong. So what happened was, is it got so bad that at one point, you know, I had to leave the job. They had to put me on workman's comp. I was rated at 40% disability, California court system. So now I'm 23 and now all my prospects for any job you could ever imagine in the world are gone. Because what job can you not use your hands 8 hours a day for? Name one. Just name one other than public speaker, actor, voiceover, radio host. You can't. You can't be. I can't work at Starbucks. I can't bartend. I can't
type.
No, I can. I use a lot of. I've been using voice dictation since 1998. I can type, but I can only do it a couple hours a day. Like, I just couldn't be in a desk job classic, but I also couldn't be in any kind of repetitive injury. So it's just like an athlete who gets, throws the ball, you know, the pitcher, and then he's out for a year and then he's back. And then, so it's a repetitive strain injury. And at the time, it just got so severe. And the doctors were like, listen, you know, you're going to have this for the rest of your life and you're never.
What was the diagnosis?
Chronic tenosynovitis, tendonitis. Yeah. So then I went on a journey of, again, like, oh, this is the first health thing. So when I got hit with hypothyroidism later, I was like, you got to be effing kidding me, right? So then this happened. And so luckily we had an insurance policy, thank God, with my company. I was able to make basically a preschool teacher salary, but be able to live and then heal. And so right after that, like the moment I got disabled, I mean, you have no idea what it's like to sit there and go, I don't even know if I'm ever going to be able to hold a cup again. Like, I will start crying now thinking about the thoughts I had, like, what guy's going to ever want me? How am I ever going to have kids? Part of the reason why I haven't, because I know all that it takes. I can't hold a baby in my arms for more than 20 minutes. Do you know what I mean? So yes, can I go play a game of tennis with you or some ping pong or go paddling? Sure. Can I do it every day? No. Am I going to be on the tennis circuit? Absolutely not. Can I go throw a game of pickup ball and horse with you? Yeah, I could be a normal person. I just can't do those things regularly. So for me to then pursue right away, I was like, what am I going to do? I got to use my voice. I got nothing else. I got nothing else. So I went right back to Chicago, went to the second city, immediately got my voiceover demo done. I was like, I got to go some direction here. Now, it turned out that all that stuff lined up with my childhood dreams anyway. I just thought it was a bullshit, ridiculous thing to pursue. And there was no way I was going to do it because I was like, no, I'm going to go for the money. See, I did. It worked. I went for the money. And then that shit got fucking injured, ruined my arms, and the universe took off the golden handcuffs. And we're like, guess not. Guess we're going back to the original. So then I had to become a broke actor. I mean, pretty, you know, making whatever, like preschool teacher salary. Thank God I had it to survive. But at the end of the day, I then was like, oh my God, you don't understand. I mean, I was looking at $250,000. So then to be regulated to making a very make a minimum wagey type of thing. But again, thank God, able to not have to inflame my arms. Then I was able to get better. So a couple of years went by. I didn't have to go to physical therapy 3 times a week. And, you know, I was in physical therapy with people that had sliced their hands off. I was at the Bunkie Clinic in San Francisco, which is famous for inventing microsurgery of limbs, like how to reattach limbs. So there were people from all over the place. Talk about a beginning lesson in gratitude, even though I didn't know. So here I am. My arms are inflamed, but I have them.
Here's a clip from Brian McKenzie, the creator of the Power Speed Endurance Movement. Check out his website. This guy is a visionary in the fitness scene, the forward-thinking coach, trainer, designer of workout protocols. He was famed for developing the CrossFit Endurance program that shook up the traditional, straightforward approach of the endurance athlete to do more and more miles and trying to get better. And now he had people mixing it up and developing into total athletes. And these days he's on the cutting edge in his use of breathing awareness and cold exposure and novel training strategies like that, putting them in right into the central focus of all the hard work that athletes are accustomed to doing. So let's hear a little bit from Brian McKenzie. He was healing from a severe neck injury and stuck in a neck brace for the whole interview, but he toughed it out, man.
My job over the last 15, 20 years has been to do something and then go back to the beginning and deconstruct and start over again with a new way of doing that or looking at it. And our, what we're currently
that's
doing.
That's a good quote for the show right there, man.
Might
I think
be.
You nailed that. Love that. Yeah. That's your job. We need you.
Well, we need a lot more. We need a lot more than me. But I think, you know, thank you. But you know, and right now the paradigm we're in is we're looking at breathing and what breathing's doing. And now we're looking at how people are breathing, not only in performance, but in everyday life. And what does that mean? And we're now starting to understand the interconnectivity of the brain and respiration and how that is absolutely a part of the your respiration is a part of your central nervous system. In fact, we believe it's the remote control. There, your emotions, your pain, your muscles going to work, stress of any sort. There are dedicated respiration patterns that go off the moment those are happening on an autonomic level. So if I'm not thinking about it, if I'm unconscious about this, these are things that are happening. But if I become conscious of it, and this is what I kind of alluded to when I had the accident, was I instantly went back to training I've been doing over the last 5-6 years, right? Where I'm like, I know that if I slow the respiration rate down, I'm not going to spin myself out. I'm not going to drop. I'm not going to put myself into this more sympathetic dominant tone that I'm already probably in because I'm in a life-threatening situation. Thus, I'm giving myself more of a peripheral vision. I'm giving myself more of a tone to learn from this and understand this in a more clear, creative fashion. And that might sound a little odd in a life-threatening situation, but the fact is that is how we learn, is you go through a very stressful situation and then you need to pull back and be able to go, oh, what was that? Oh my gosh, that made sense. It's, you know, if you go watch the action sports community, you'll see skateboarders, and you know, like I've worked with a lot of skateboarders and professional surfers and big wave surfers, and they just keep going and going and going. And when they're failing, and then all of a sudden, boom, they get it once. And it's, they've calmed down, they've let go, they've repeated something enough to where they've stressed themselves out enough to where they let go, or they show up the next day and it just happens. And these are very interesting things. If you look at sports like action sports, I mean, how much has surfing changed in the last 20 years? How much has skateboarding, snowboarding, skiing changed in the last 20 years? You can't really put statistics on what they're doing rotationally and all of these things with the tricks. You go back and look at where that started and you're going, oh my God. You go look at running and, you know, you go look at working sports, you know, rowing, the times aren't that different. They haven't made that big of a change. And so when we start looking at things like that, what are they doing? And obviously there's very different things at work here, but what's happening with these athletes versus the other? And so, you know, this is all part of what we're looking at with even the brain and even respiration, breathing, how it correlates, how it works together, what we can do to help reset or give people tools to use in real time or in time of pre-training, post-training, competition, all of that, and what it can do.
Oh my gosh, the next clip, such a nice voice as I'm reviewing the material. And I recognize it. It's the Mia Moore Show. Dun, 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 my favorite podcast guest and favorite person. And she's talking about partners needing to vent and what you're supposed to do, which is to not give advice, just be supportive. A nice little clip from our wonderful show talking about healthy relationship dynamics with much more to come as Mia Moore has some future appearances slated, but let's hear what she's got to say in this nice clip.
You have to make a conscious choice not to sweat the small stuff. It's not easy. Most people by instinct, you know, want to get their way, or, you know, they do get upset over just the minutia of life, you know?
Well, the other part of that is, what do you deem to be small stuff? And it gets a little tricky because if a partner comes through the door and gives you a bunch of shit because they had a bad day, and then we read articles from Chris Gage on the Medium, one of the best relationship commentary, short and to the point and memorable. And she says, emotional control and emotional self-stability is the number one priority for a winning, healthy relationship. And everything else is secondary if you don't have that. So do you draw a boundary, or do you say, this is just small stuff that this person's venting and saying things that they don't really mean, and I'm going to forgive them when they calm down? That's a tricky issue to navigate.
Well, it depends how that person's venting. If somebody's just venting because of a bad day at the office, they're not going to be directing it at their partner. They're going to come in and say, hey, I had a bad day, and can I vent? That's how I would do it. I just need a vent. And something that I think men in particular, and maybe women, I've had girlfriends who have talked about this before too. The other partner, when who's listening to their partner vent, has to remember they're not to give advice. When someone's venting, they don't want to hear you tell them what they need to do. They probably already figured it out. They just want to have someone hear them vent, and someone say, oh, wow, what a day, you know, can I rub your feet, or can I make you a cocktail, or, you know, or just come sit here, let's watch TV, or just, but they want to just hear, they want to say it. And I know it helps me sometimes when I'm venting. Sometimes I'm just in my car driving home and I vent out loud, and that's enough to just get it out of your system. Yeah. But we don't need anyone to tell us, you know, advice. And I mean, that works with both sides, some, you know, the husband or the wife, it doesn't matter. Or when you're venting to your girlfriends, any type of relationship, it doesn't have to be, you know, your spouse. It could be your sister. It could be your parent. Regardless, when someone's venting, they just want to vent. People need to stop trying to fix other people's lives in that situation. Well, actually, in any situation.
Here's a clip from Dr. Alicia Goldstein, clinical psychologist and co-founder of the Center for Mindful living in Los Angeles. And yes, I popped into the center. This was sort of a random connection. I didn't know anything about this guy. And we sat down and he rocked my world, man. I still think about many of the insights he provided during this show about being mindful. He's talking in this clip about our tendency to brace. And that is not a good thing. That's when we get stressed, we get reactive, and here's some tips about what we can do about it. Listen to the whole show for much more from Alicia Goldstein.
Viktor Frankl was a psychiatrist and Holocaust survivor. You're familiar with him. He has a great quote that's been attributed to him that said, between stimulus and response, there's a space. In that space lies our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. And so really, the first step to be able to step into that space and get more familiar with it between the stimulus and response, because the stimulus, that space is like tiny at
the
moment.
It can be quick sometimes.
Right? Yeah, it's not even there. It's like,
bump, bump. Hey, you asshole, you just cut me off. Yeah.
Or there's my phone, let me pick it up and check. Yeah. Right? Even though I just checked it 15 seconds ago.
Uh-huh.
I think that the statistic right now is the average person is on their phone 11 hours a day or something like that.
I saw that, yeah. The kids, they're referencing the number of text messages the average teenager sends is mind-blowing. Yeah.
And it's intense, stressful to be interacting that much. It's brain overload.
Yeah.
But so the number thing, one thing we can do as a precursor to support us into widening that space is really to learn how to actively relax our nervous systems.
Mm.
And, you know, one way of a very simple way of doing that, like that anyone can do anywhere, anytime without taking like 30 minutes out to sit and do a meditation is to go get a massage or something, is to just be on the lookout. It's very simple. This is one of the first things I teach people in this 6-month immersion online course called A Course in Mindful Living is be on the lookout where in your regular life your body is bracing. So where is your body tensing? Because your body is now holding the patterning of and the programming, the automatic programming. And so where is it bracing? Because that's telling you that you're stressed in that moment. And so if you're stressed, you're going to kind of make more mistakes typically. I mean, a little bit of stress is okay. A lot of stress, that's where we get into trouble, right? And so if your body is bracing, the first step is to actively soften your body. If you do this, like let's say 3 times a day, you just do it 3 times a day. And this, again, this takes no time out. Actively, or maybe there's tension in your shoulder. You notice it's really intense. And so you actively choose to just stretch that area to open it a little bit. You're going to notice some big changes. You're going to be a little bit more aware in your day. You're going to start widening that space between stimulus and response to be more open to the choices and possibilities that are there for you in the moment. Like, oh, do I really need to check this again after I checked it 15, 30 seconds ago? Do I want to pay attention to my kid who's trying to talk to me right now? Or my partner who's trying to like talk to me right now, telling me something really emotional that's an important part of their day, you know, or whatever it is. You'll get better at paying attention to what matters. And in order to hone our attention, the first step is learning how to relax our bodies.
So noticing those times when you're bracing, going, oh, there I go bracing. I guess I do that in traffic a lot or on tough conversations on the phone or something.
Some people do that the moment they wake up in the morning. Their body is bracing from the alarm. If they have kids in the house or a partner, a tough conversation, it's right there in the morning. Some bad news in the morning, whatever it is. The anticipation of the traffic and getting out on time, the email, the mountain of emails. Sometimes when you think you're having fun and getting soothing through flipping through the variety of apps, really kind of check in with yourself and see how your body's doing in that moment.
Huh.
Your body might be kind of stressed trying to get out that, you know, 10-line text that you're trying to kind of beat out before you have to go somewhere else or whatever it
is. Before the light changes.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, we just check in. Your body's keeping score a bit, and it's kind of telling you, you know, how you're doing. That you're in a way that your thoughts may not realize in that moment. And the first step is to just actively. First of all, what you start noticing as you're doing it is it's enjoyable. You start really enjoying relaxing your body. Your car rides are better. Your relationships are better. You feel better in your life when you're more relaxed. It's our natural state to feel kind of more calm and balanced. We just happen to live in a very frenetic world that really activates our nervous systems in major ways right now.
Listen to the Sisson, people. Here's an excerpt from the ultimate Mark Sisson interview. Yes, I pinned that busy guy down, and we talk for almost 2 hours about his life journey that's got him to the point where he is today, a leader in the health space with an incredible following and his amazing business success with the Primal Kitchen Enterprise. But it's been a wild road, and Mark has some tremendous insights to provide about the entrepreneurial journey and the proper mindset, our willingness to tolerate risk, and what that says about our personalities and how we have to align that with our decisions. So an interesting clip here from my main man, Mark Sisson.
I take calculated risks, but they're still risks. I mean, I'm willing to take a risk. That's what an entrepreneur does. An entrepreneur is willing to take risk, willing to risk capital or time in order to achieve what that person thinks is an outcome, a product, a service, or something that will benefit the marketplace and contribute to the economy in a way that is meaningful. So I don't think I have this particular, risky gene. I'm in fact probably quite the opposite. But in business, you just sort of look at the data and you say, on balance, this is something that looks like a good idea. I'm willing to invest time or money or whatever in it, and prove the model and see if it works. And if it does, great, I'll scale it. If it doesn't, I'll move on to the next thing.
Here's a spicy clip. What other kind could there be? From Dr. Wendy Walsh, the 2017 Time Magazine Co-Person of the Year for her role in the Me Too movement. She's the one that called out Bill O'Reilly and kind of triggered his downfall for all the nonsense nastiness he was engaged in. And Wendy Walsh has got a great show of her own called Mating Matters on iHeartRadio. You can find it on all the podcast channels. Always clever and riveting insights about relationship dynamics in the modern world from her perspective as an evolutionary psychologist. And in this clip, she's talking about the top three attributes that men are looking for in a woman, and likewise that our women are looking for in a man. Pretty interesting stuff. You'll never forget it when you hear the list.
Okay, so back to the biology. We had the men, 1, 2, 3, was they're looking for youth and beauty, maybe around 7 years younger or so. Or if you insist on a peer, then someone who looks young.
Who looks young, who tricks the eye.
Second was loyalty. I want to give like cues for the listener to remember. So okay. We've got Kendrick Lamar, loyalty, number two. And then finally, kindness. I love that one.
And kindness, in the end of the day, if you're, love evolve, love is real. It's a combination of hormones that affect our psychology, and it evolved to keep people together long enough to raise some kids and get them out of the nest. So monogamy is natural for many of us, at least for a period of time, to help kids get up and out. Now, women, on the other hand,
here we go.
They tend to look, if you had to guess, what's the number one thing women look for in a guy?
Oh, okay. I would guess something to do with...
Be shallow, it's true.
Status, a display of...
Money. Money, right. Resources.
Wow. So,
resources. So again, back in our anthropological past, during the
very... Mercedes-Benz.
During the very...
Number one, our survey said, ding, ding.
But now women can buy their own. But back in our anthropological past, during the vulnerable years of pregnancy and nursing, we needed a guy to bring us back protein and bring that woolly mammoth and get that and protect us during that time. So having status, power, resources, that's what's even the most successful women. Sociologists have coined a phrase called the George Clooney effect, which is the more educated a woman becomes, the more money she makes, she still wants a man who's a little older and a little richer.
Why?
Because it's the George Clooney effect. She's wired to go for resources.
Right.
And it gets hard when you're the woman making the most money, right? Women don't like to date down financially. They don't. So that's the first thing women look for.
But they do frequently, especially a high wealth woman who is maybe, you see examples, maybe it's troubling, but I know examples of a stay-at-home daddy where the woman's a high income earner. and everything's great. It seems like maybe they're switching roles. So you could say like the...
So those examples exist, but they're not necessarily what we evolved to have.
Right.
Right. Okay. Looking at an anecdotal example is not the same as looking at a culture-wide trend.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're saying there's this huge pressure. There's this huge force inside the woman that is going to be wired to look for resources.
To still look up from her place of point.
Even though she don't need it because she rolling,
right,
you know,
exactly.
She got Cardi B. She went from dollar bills. Now I'm popping rubber bands.
What happens sexually to that couple?
What happens? The lack of desire because the wiring, you're not hitting the right wiring.
Plenty of these men, not all, again, there are lots of happy marriages where the woman makes more. But because our culture associates wage earning with manhood, and a lot of men are trapped in these man boxes, is not necessarily a good thing. I'm not saying it's good, but it exists.
Right. Good qualifier.
When a man makes less than the woman, he's far more likely to cheat.
Oh.
Because he needs to get his manhood somehow. He needs to prove his self-identity.
Let's listen to the Mac Attack talk some smack. This is my old friend and triathlon compatriot, Andrew McNaughton, one of the greatest triathletes of all time with his wonderful career back in the 80s and 90s. And then he's been coaching athletes with a unique and evolved approach that I think is second to none with comparison to all the offerings that are out there that are overly focused on the technical aspects of training and competing in triathlon. So here, Mac Attack is trying to set your mind straight a little bit, talking about what really is fun about training and racing. It's not really the suffering, it's actually going fast. And when you think about it in that perspective, you start to hopefully improve your decision-making processes and get out of that trap of that type A, highly motivated, goal-oriented mindset that leads to overworking, struggling, and suffering instead of making the best decisions for your athletic potential. Andrew McNaughton.
Most people who are doing these endurance sports do them because they love them. And if they don't, they're too long and tedious to do. So I can't imagine why you would be doing it if it wasn't out of love. And so why would you risk that fun to get in an extra workout when you're taking the chance of getting injured or sick,
or bored,
or fried or whatever, when you could, you know, continue to do this. And as we know with endurance sports, it's consistency over a long time that makes you better. It's never one workout. You know, one workout can ruin you, but it can't make you. So, it's just, you keep those things in mind. And I understand that it's hard for the go-getters and the people who, you know, like to write things down and accomplish their goals. But you have to realize that when you write down workouts to do, those aren't necessarily your goals. Those are the steps that you believe that will lead you to your goal. But if time doesn't permit on one day, then it doesn't mean that step is necessary to reach your goal. It quite often means that including that step now will actually interfere with reaching your ultimate goal, which is doing better at your next race or the next one or whatever it is. Right. So, that's something to keep in mind with busy bodies and travel for work or sick children who are keeping you up so you can't sleep or whatever it might be. Understand that.
Go with the flow.
Enjoy this excerpt from Amanda Renteria. I hit her up cold call because I saw this incredible news article about this woman who ran for the governor of the state of California. I think she took 7th place or 9th place, but her unlikely ascendance into a high profile political role. She was the national director of Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. And my gosh, from her modest beginnings as daughter of migrant farm workers in California's Central Valley off to the hallowed halls of Stanford. And you're not going to believe on this excerpt how she talks about paying for her education by becoming a scholarship athlete on the Stanford women's basketball team, the number one team in the nation, perennial number one at that time. And oh man, anything's possible when you dream and you believe in yourself. And here goes Amanda Renteria telling you all about it.
Did you say you were a college athlete?
I was. I played basketball and softball at Stanford.
You played basketball and softball.
I did. Strangely, I didn't actually intend to really play sports. When I got to college, when I got to Stanford, because I knew how difficult it was going to be, just to make it through academically coming from the school and the place that I came from. So when I went in to talk to my academic advisor, I happened to mention, how am I going to pay for this thing? Right. I was so fearful that my parents at any moment would have me go back, because it was a big stretch for them, right? A Mexican immigrant father, a mom who was in the schools, pretty conservative Mexican parents. And the idea of me going 4 hours away was quite scary, especially because my dad like had this rule that if we went to prom, he had to talk to our dates for at least a half an hour.
Oh, so this is a cultural thing.
Right.
Mi novia no puede ir afuera para colegio.
Right.
Ella va por Sac State. She lived at home with her sister getting a four-year degree, and she could have gone to UCLA or wherever she wanted. So the stretch was like sort of this emotional cultural thing too, where you're living in extended generation families and all these kind of things.
That's right. And so it was incredibly far away.
Are you saying there was a financial stretch too? Because I thought that these days, tell me the difference between when you went and now, because I thought there's big differences going on.
Huge differences. Oh, okay. Schools are making really great strides on helping kids through. It wasn't quite like that when I went. It was $22,000 a year, which was the biggest number I'd ever heard of. And, you know, for me, I also just didn't understand that when you graduate, you have loans. And I was so fearful that I was so blessed that my parents did let me go. And then I was so fearful at any moment they would make me come back. And when I heard that I was going to have loans, or that I was going to get the tuition and it was going to, I was going to end up graduating with loans, I thought, if my parents find out about this, then I'm going to have to somehow go back.
Here's their daughter at Stanford about to get in big trouble because she pulled some loans. Oh,
right,
my goodness.
Right. But I just, it was more naive, right? I didn't know. And so when I asked my academic advisor, well, how can I pay for this whole thing? And she sort of looked at me a little bit like, don't worry about it. You're going to be fine. You're going to have a Stanford degree. I was like, you don't understand. In order to get the Stanford degree, I have to figure this out.
Hey, enjoy this interview with Christopher Kelly, the founder, the proprietor of the wonderful Nourish Balance Thrive health testing and consultation program. And I am a client. I put myself through the ringer and got an amazing assortment of blood, stool, urine, saliva testing. They ran through the most advanced testing you can find anywhere, and then took me through step by step all the results and all the protocols and the supplements, lifestyle behavior changes recommended. It's an amazing all-encompassing program. And Chris is a leader in using intelligence software to predict and help diagnose and guide people with health decisions. This is cutting edge stuff, man. And that's what he's doing. So check out his website over there. But here he talks about his own background as an extreme high performing racing cyclist and overdoing it and learning all these lessons the hard way that he brings to his career today. And interesting note that I can totally relate to are those times when you're really in a groove and you're performing well, but meanwhile, you're kind of trashing your health and you feel like crap maybe in daily life, but you can still get out there on the bike and pound due to the effects, the temporary performance enhancing effects of excessive stress hormone production, of course, leading to long-term adverse health consequences. So a little clip from a real athlete who's doing his thing to help others these days at Nourish Balance Thrive, Chris Kelly.
If I were living in London and I turn on my phone and there's like 19 Wi-Fi signals.
I hate that, man.
I mean, what are you going to do? I think that worrying about it is probably going to do more harm. And so these are Tommy's words now. Worrying about it is probably going to do more harm than the actual thing itself. So forget about it. Do the things, pull the levers you've got access to, and then forget about the ones that you don't.
Right. Don't stress. I want to go back to your story a little bit there when you were this young racing dude who's succeeding and performing well, but meanwhile, your health is cratering before you know it. But for that time period there where you're still performing and still winning races and doing magnificent athletic feats, how does that work? I know Maffetone has mentioned this a little bit, where this overstress pattern or this overstimulation pattern can, for a short period of time, deliver these amazing results. And you're setting PRs because you're bathed in these stress hormones that deliver peak performance effort while chipping away at your immune system.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. You just answered your own question quite well there. I think that's exactly right. Yeah, I noticed that on the bike was about the only time that I felt good. And it wasn't immediate. Like, I wouldn't want to do it. Like, I'd be sat in the office thinking, I used to be able to finish work at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and go ride my bike.
What time did you start work?
5 o'clock in the morning.
Right. So you're going 5 to 1 and then hitting more stress after that.
Yeah.
Crazy times.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a terribly stressful job, but I'd be sat there at midday thinking, I really don't want to go ride my bike right now.
Right.
I really don't want to go. But then I don't want to go home either. I would like, you know, I'd get the train back home and that wouldn't be fun either. I'd get home and I'd be sat there miserable. Why did I do that? I was stupid. I should have gone ride. So I would invariably go ride instead. And then it would take a while, usually about an hour. And then an hour in, you start to get some of that cortisol going that we've already talked about is really, really low. And yeah, I'd start to feel good. And that was one of the few times where I would feel good. And that's kind of addictive, isn't it? If that's what you need to do in order to feel good, then you're probably going to do more of it.
You're getting a hit of dope, like a drug user, right? Because that cortisol is spiking due to the fight or flight stimulation of your ride. And I know that pattern very well myself, where I was exhausted during daily life. But as soon as I jumped in the water, I rallied because I was so focused and driven to be a competitive athlete. And that sets you up for a very slippery slope downward when you can't even function normally and healthily in everyday life.
Right. I think this does lead into exercise dependency, where you can't... You know, I used to be that guy that couldn't go anywhere unless I had a bike on the back of the car. Couldn't possibly go on holiday unless I brought my bike with me. You know, and I'd be on the turbo trainer if it was raining outside. On the 6 days a year that it rains in Northern California, I'd be indoors on the turbo trainer. And now I'm not like that at all. I can just take it or leave it. Okay, should I ride it today? No. All right, that's fine. I'll just ride tomorrow or maybe the day after and that's okay. And I don't really notice if I take 3 weeks off after cyclocross season, I don't really notice that I'm really missing the exercise. It's just all the same now. And I think this has got to be part of it, isn't it? Not being dependent on exercise.
Here's a little clip from an interview with my childhood friend, Dave Cobreen. And the show's great. He talks about his world-beating morning routine. I think you're going to get a lot of inspiration from hearing how he starts his day every single day. He's also had an amazing athletic journey of his own and others in his family, the athletic Cobreen family. So you're going to get a lot of tips and insights as a parent guiding your children through the athletic journey. He has two scholarship volleyball players at UCLA, first team All-American high school superstars, and putting a vote in for the hands-off approach. Let destiny run its course. Don't try to force things to happen that aren't naturally meant to be. Maybe you'll parent some first-team All-American high school athletes, and maybe not. Maybe you'll just help them become better persons and achieve personal growth in the process of pursuing athletic goals. But here's a little clip from Dave down at UCLA when they were the number one college basketball dynasty and him walking into the coach's office and announcing that he was ready to play on the team and would like a uniform, please. Dave Cobreen.
So Larry Brown, noted NBA and college coach, probably a Hall of Fame level coach who did so many things, including take Allen Iverson and the Sixers to the finals, one of the worst teams to ever make it to the NBA finals besides Allen.
At one point, he had the Clippers' best record ever as a coach.
Wow. Yeah, he was known for like jumping in and turning places around and then leaving soon after. He was very peripatetic, right? So you had a spot on the varsity, and were they pretty good at that time?
Yeah, I think we were number one ranked at the time. I mean, I had a spot, yeah, but let's just be honest about that. I don't make any be honest about it. I was really the 13th man on a 12-man team. You
know? that's gonna be a pull quote for the podcast. The 13th. Listen to how understated this guy is. I mean, this
it's
is
true.
a kid from the Valley, San Fernando Valley, who you know liked basketball, made it work in high school. Your teammates. The cool thing about that Taft team, it was so well oiled because you guys were buddies, and you just go and it was poetry to watch, especially the city quarterfinal game, which he's turning red now if you're not watching, because I tease him about this all the time. But you tore that house down. Like, it was one of the greatest athletic performances I've ever seen, because this is a do or die game. And like you expressed, that dream of playing in front of the 10,000 fans in the city finals, you got to get through the
qualifying.
At Pauley Pavilion, the UCLA home, John Wooden's home. I mean, Wooden was just leaving at that that point. He was still fresh. He had fresh footprints. You know, his rolled up program was still on the floor. He
was at every game.
Right. He's still watching every game, of course. So this quarterfinal game, and I think you guys were favored, but you were struggling. And then you went on this binge, which reportedly was filmed on beta by Ron Coburn, number one sports fan. We haven't located it yet. I have a bounty on that video because I want to see it, because it was just one of the greatest things. But you want me to describe it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, or I want to hear it from you.
You could describe it because you probably know it better than I do at this point.
Yeah, yeah. So the team's down by a lot, and the time's running out in the game, and you put a bucket in, right? And then we come down the court, and you get a steal.
Right.
So you got a steal and went in for another bucket.
Dunk.
And went in for the dunk. And then what was the third thing?
I stole the inbound pass.
Right, right.
Got fouled.
So here we have a basket by Coburn, stealing a steal picked off the dribble. Picked off the dribble at midcourt, in for a dunk. The crowd's going crazy. We realize we're back in the game. And then you steal the inbound pass and go in for an and one. So if we're counting at home, that's 2, 4, 6. And then did you drop the free throw? So 7 points. How much time off the clock?
Well, according to you, it was 15 seconds.
Okay, 7 points in 15 seconds. I think it was less than that. But that pretty much, if you can imagine a high school gym of kids screaming like crazy, and then we flooded the court afterward, and so here's this guy up on people's shoulders, and then had the balls to knock on Larry Brown's door. I love that.
Well, that story, to be honest, I think only two people remember that, me and you.
Hey, listen to this clip and drag in your young players and have them listen to it too. What an amazing young man. His name is Isaac Rochelle. He's a young player in the National Football League. Yep, he made it all the way to the big show, playing defensive end for the Los Angeles Chargers out of Notre Dame. And he talks about turning adversity into opportunity and taking control of his mindset. Instead of whining and complaining when he got demoted from the Chargers active squad to the practice squad, he looked at it as a blessing to get himself better. And boy, we see these athletes on television, and they're such physical marvels that you tend to focus on that, and they're so genetically gifted and amazing and strong and fast, but really the mindset is behind a lot of the success and determining who makes it and who doesn't. And that's why guys like Isaac will persevere and prosper. Listen to him talk about how he handled adversity with the Chargers.
So you made that first incredible cut to the roster. How was that? And then what was it like to get that practice squad notice after the first game?
Initially it was really exciting. And then after the first week, I was really frustrated, but it was really important for my growth. And like I've mentioned earlier in our conversation, the adversity piece, that was some adversity. And I was, like I said, I came to the facility every day frustrated, not with the staff, but with myself. And I just challenged myself, and it ended up working out in my favor. But I think it was important because up to that point in my career, I had never really been challenged. Like at Notre Dame, I was a captain my senior year. I started for 3 years. In high school, I started pretty much the whole time. And so I think for me, it was a wake-up call. Not everything in your football career and in life is just going to be given to you. So it was cool. Looking back now, it seems like, wow, that was really cool. That was a learning experience. During it, I was really frustrated, but definitely thankful for it.
Did you feel that it was inequitable? Like they didn't see your skills or weren't given a chance to perform? Or did you screw up in the first game and they yanked you out of the scene? Or how did that go down?
No, it was a numbers thing. I had a good first game, we just had too many D linemen. And I'm super strict with myself though in areas like this. Like even if I did think that they were mistreating me or shortchanging me, if I'm in that position, I have to self-evaluate no matter what. So regardless of what they were thinking, I had to look at it as an opportunity to capitalize. And that's what I did. But I don't think they were shortchanging me or treating me unfairly. I think I needed to get better. So I have no problem with their decision. I was just frustrated with myself.
So the frustration, did it come from
that maybe you didn't work quite as hard as you possibly could have, or something where you slipped and you knowingly self-evaluate and reflect?
I don't know that it's ever been a work ethic issue. I think it's just more of focusing on different areas and changing my attitude. And I don't think I ever came in the facility and I was arrogant or pretentious or anything like that. I think that's like a humbling experience to essentially get fired. So I don't know. I don't know. It's hard to give it a label. I just kind of had to like self-evaluate and figure out what needed to change.
And so you're there, you're part of the entire process, but you're not suiting up for the games for this period of time that you're on the practice squad. And does that change every week? Can you be called upon at any time?
Yeah. So you're always ready. It's week to week in the NFL. It's like team to team. So you could get cut from one team and get picked up by the next team and be playing the next Sunday for a different team. So it's really fluid.
K-Star, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Kelly Starrett, one of the greatest live performers, instructors I've ever seen. He absolutely captivated the Primal Con audience when we had him in to do his core area of expertise is the flexibility, mobility training. He is the proprietor of the ReadyState.com website where everything's all coordinated now, all the wonderful work he's done helping people heal and prevent injury. But interestingly, on our lengthy podcast interview, he went off on a whole bunch of important tangents and how they're applicable to the bread and butter of executing the squat properly or warming up and strengthening your shoulders after an injury and all those things. So even in this little clip, he gets pretty philosophical. He's talking about the potential adverse influence of technology, and we got into that in detail on the show. His big topic is plug your phone outside your bedroom. Don't be tempted. Set yourself up to succeed. If you got a little kid, park a mile away from school and walk it in every day. Doing these kind of things to improve your life, and I think you're going to love the little clip and the whole show from an amazing free thinker and leader in the health and fitness scene for a long time, Dr. Kelly Starrett of TheReadyState.com.
Your parents were a product of McDonald's. You don't know. And what we're seeing is that people, this is a normal expression of the system, and this sounds terrible because I am a Carl Rogers believer, like unconditional positive regard. Tomorrow you can reinvent yourself. Like it's never too late for anyone, but we are going to be so slow. The glacial pace is already breakneck. It takes time, right? You guys have been beating this drum about just, hey, be reasonable longer than anyone else has protein power life plan aside. Right? I mean, we are going to capture people, but we may lose a generation. That's what I feel like. And that's because it's we're going to get them the information and the abilities too late because they can't hear it. Jamie Oliver went to West Virginia and was like, "Yeah, you can't eat pizza for breakfast." And they were like, "What are you talking about?" And he was like, "You're mad," and did it in a way where people didn't respect the fact that wow, it's really like they hadn't heard that before. And I think when you put this all into context, which is one of the problems with the phone. And the internet doesn't give us context, and you can't. It's easy for me to be like, "This is bullshit." I saw your Instagram post. It's a snapshot. A long time ago, we really made a commitment not to comment on anyone's position or mechanics on the internet because you don't know what's going on. So you're like, "Oh, look at that crappy position," but I'm like, "Dude, did that person have a back injury? Mm. Did they wear combat boots for 20 years? Did they just get off an air? Like, you don't know. So don't until you have the context, like, mm-hmm. don't criticize." And I think that's really important is to put the context back in. We now are into the sixth year of our kids at an all standing school. So my daughter in the fifth grade has never sat at a desk, and when we started that conversation, people were like, "This is crazy, but we'll do it." Now it is just like whatever, it's not even a thing. So you know, first and foremost, there are clearly principles that allow the human being to function the way a human being does. And it's confusing because the engineering is really robust. Yes, you can walk, you can run like a jerk, slam your heel to the ground, collapse your, I mean, you can run like that for a long time, and then all one day you can't. And you're like, I don't understand. I've been doing it the whole way, right? You can eat terribly for a long time. You
can six pack still.
You can smoke cigarettes and eat a little chocolate donut and win a gold medal. I have friends who do that, right? And, then one day you can't, or your physiology. So it's important that we run the experiment and think, hey, this is an open experiment. And I can't definitively say you can't do that until you die, because I'm worried now that we're all going to be 100, but the quality of our lives between 65 and 100 is not what's possible. That's what we need to be thinking of.
We're already seeing that. Yeah. We're seeing the life extended by all kinds of mechanical medical means, but the quality of life sucks.
Yeah, and I think the quality of life begins to it begins to get smaller. The allegory is, you know, I'm a physical therapist, and I worked in hospitals a lot. And the irony, and as an aside, and this isn't funny, but I spent more time in the inside of, like, high level. Given what I do for a living now, I was the in my school. I spent more time in the ICU and inpatient settings than anyone else.
Why?
Just the luck of the draw. Like, oh, they were okay. Like, oh, Kelly, you're going back to cardiac rehab. And I'm like, okay, here we go. You know, I spent more time not doing what I'm doing, and I'm so grateful. But towards the end of life, your world gets small. You're in your house, and then you're in a hospital, and then your window gets smaller, and then you're in the ICU. And literally, you don't walk out. You don't leave this room. And that's literally the same thing, the sort of loss of capacity. And the for all of us, hey, I don't jump. I don't run. I can't get up and down off the ground. The number one reason we end up in nursing homes in the United States is we can't get up off the ground.
Hey, we get to catch up with the busy man himself, Ben Greenfield, the world's extreme biohacker of all times. No one goes deeper than this guy. No one produces more content. His brain is functioning at the highest level imaginable, and he's written great books like Beyond Training and his new book from 2020, Boundless. He's so into the high tech, into the science. He can give keynote presentations to physicians and groups of people that are way out there on the cutting edge. But what a great little excerpt here when he talks about the importance of family dinners in the evening and the celebratory environment that you want to create around mealtimes, and also not being too stressed and too keyed up about the exact particulars of your macronutrients or your calories. Just living life, enjoying life, and bringing it all together. You gotta love Ben Greenfield. Here he is with a little clip. Listen to the whole show.
You see a lot of people not sleeping well on a strict ketogenic diet versus folks who do an evening carbohydrate feed often have great sleep because of the serotonin availability. So that's one reason that I like the carbohydrates in the evening. And then the other reason would be, for me, and for a lot of people living in a Western society where we're not, say, following some Ayurvedic principle of, you know, a decent breakfast, lunching kind of like a king, like a great big lunch, you know, followed by a siesta usually, and then like a pretty paltry dinner. You know, in a lot of westernized societies, dinner is kind of the prime meal of the day, and it sucks to go out to a restaurant or to sit down with your family and have to be incredibly restrictive, right? Like, I like going to a restaurant when they bring that wonderful warm plate of bread out to the table, you know, some heirloom local sourdough or something like that with big pads of butter. You know, I'll indulge all night long on that type of thing. And, you know, so from a social standpoint, allowing yourself to refeed a little bit more in the evening, especially from a carbohydrate perspective, is important. And then the other thing is that for my family, I think family dinners are incredibly important. It's a way for our own family to gather at the end of the day. In the morning, the kids are off getting ready for school and everybody's rushing around. It's just way too busy to sit down for a family, you know, as a family for an hour. So then lunch, you know, the kids aren't around and my wife's often out, you know, gardening or farming or, you know, taking care of the chickens or the goats, or she's off playing tennis. And, you know, lunch is just kind of an afterthought for us. But then dinner, our entire family comes together at the end of the day and we'll play table topics and we'll play, you know, Pictionary, which I hate because I got to stop eating every 2 minutes to draw some picture. But we'll play Texas Hold'em. We'll talk about the day. And so it's a time for our family to bond. And I actually, because of that, like we eat dinner actually later than what I consider to be healthy. Right? Like I think in an ideal scenario, you'd have dinner just for digestion and everything done with before you kind of go horizontal for the night. You'd have dinner over with 2 or 3 hours before bed. But our family gathers at about 8:30 at night. And, you know, we'll finish dinner around 9 or 9:30 and we're usually in bed by 10, but we have these amazing evening family dinners that are just like, those are a crucial part of our family dynamics. And when the kids are off doing jujitsu and tennis and soccer and piano and all these things at the end of the day, we can't have a 6 p.m. dinner. So we have dinner at like 8 or 8:30. And yeah, that's another scenario in which, you know, whatever we've decided to eat, I eat. And my kids love to cook too. And they'll often make risottos and, you know, and cookies and desserts and, you know, like, you know, rice cakes with fish and all sorts of things that would cause dad to be kind of a bore if I had to sit there with a spoon and a stick of butter.
Hey, let's listen to Martin Bronze, retired Silicon Valley business executive turned automobile racer and all around sharp guy. And I love his insights. I brought him on the show because as a leader in the workplace, he was the CEO of the company that I worked for. He had a unique way of leading that made people feel empowered and valued and kind of looking past some of the traditional corporate, you know, circumstances that we have that can be a little bit deflating and defeating. And he always made these points in front of the entire community there at the company that we want to have an egalitarian atmosphere, two-way communication streets, all these great insights that I think you'll love when you listen to the full-length interview. But right here in this clip, he's talking about a little bit about the Covey Quadrant and perhaps celebrating the routine, the ordinary, the people that pace themselves and get their work done on time, in addition to celebrating the great extreme performance victories that you have in the workplace too, that are more apparent than the people who are plugging away doing a great job. Nice little clip from Martin Bronze.
You got to be a little suspicious of that kind of heroism. I don't know if you remember the little chat I used to give about Quadrant 2. I think the author Stephen Covey,
right,
initially coined this, but the notion of, you know, being aware of what's urgent and important, but maybe what's important and not yet urgent. So it's important when you're building a corporate culture or just managing a team, celebrating heroism is done a lot, right? And it is in the American culture and the American corporate culture. It's celebrated, you know, the sales guy that brings in the multi-million-dollar deal on the stroke of midnight on the last day of the quarter. He's celebrated, and, you know, rightly so. He did something material and maybe critical for the company, right? Or the software engineer that sleeps under his desk and gets that last important line of code done. That's great. But I think it's important to celebrate people who plan appropriately and get their work done in a paced and measured way. Maybe that code gets written over a period of weeks.
Yeah, how did that bug happen in the first place?
Exactly.
Was it sloppy, you know? 2 a.m.
Yeah. And I would assert
maybe
that
not,
the quality of the work in the software or in the writing or whatever the work product happens to be, the quality of the output is going to be vastly better if it's something that's worked on. And we all know this even from school, right? The term paper you're writing will be vastly better if you spend 2 weeks working on it, researching it in a measured and paced way. It'll be vastly better than the term paper you write, burning the midnight oil in a 6-hour crunch the night before it's due, right? And so it is with the work world, right? So I think it's great to celebrate heroes, is my point. That's good. Celebrate heroes in the corporate world, but look for and watch for the folks that get the results done, but through non-heroic, well-planned, paced and measured, thoughtful work, right? So I was always on the lookout for the kind of people that, you know, got the stuff done, got the great big sales deal in, and got it in way before end of quarter,
right,
way before deadline. Yeah. Celebrate those people.
Hey, here's a clip from my first interview with Dave Rossi, the Hurricane. And this guy hits it hard with life-changing personal growth insights. He's the author of an incredible book called The Imperative Habit, and we'll have a future podcast coming up focusing on the principles in the book. But here he's talking about the influence of the ego. The ego is a false version of yourself. He also touches on how our fears and our negative emotions can kind of take control of us and how to not let that happen. Just a brief excerpt, much more to come from the Dave Rossi Show. Enjoy.
So your ego or your false version of yourself, I think when we use ego, people think, oh, I don't have an ego, so that's not me. Ego is just another word for a false version of yourself. Okay. And so I don't want people to run with that word ego and all of a sudden think about, oh, I don't have an ego problem. I don't drive a convertible and I'm not having a crisis. Okay. I mean, a false version of yourself. And a false version of yourself is when you feel something, when you say something, when you act in a certain way that you're not choosing, then you're not yourself. If you feel fear, like I said, stop, process that. Just because you feel it doesn't mean it's real. So if you run with that, that's not really you. You're running and living in falsehoods. You're not processing what this fear came from. It's just something that's running you off down the river and you're saying, oh my God, I'm afraid. Oh my God, I have to do this. Oh, you know, you're not really planning out your next move. If you're not in control of what you feel and what you say, if you can't control exactly what you want to say, then somebody else is. And that somebody else is your fear mechanism, this big part of your brain that reacts for you.
So an example would be getting into an argument on the basketball court and almost coming to blows because you couldn't control your ego or your...
I'll give you a great example. This weekend, my son had a water polo tournament. And their team was winning, and the goalie became more and more frustrated. And you saw him begin to unravel. You saw the goalie of the other team throwing the ball, come on, guys, get it together. And I'm thinking, you know, this guy isn't in control, and he's going to play worse and worse and worse the more he begins to blame his teammates for, you know, more shots being taken on him. He's not in control of his emotions if he thinks being upset and emotional is going to make him a better player or make his team a better team. Yelling at them isn't necessarily going to motivate them. And unraveling and yelling and getting frustrated and showing, displaying all this emotion isn't going to help him be a better goalie.
Hey, here's a great clip from my interview with Geeta Sivanda. She is a dynamic expression coach, focusing mainly on helping people become better public speakers, but also just better presentation value overall, even in the dating scene and other applications. So she brings in a lot of different skills and experiences to her training, her teachings, integrated physical therapy, yoga, dance, NLP, somatic movement, and all mixing it together to be the best that you can be. And in this clip, she's talking about being authentic and vulnerable, being yourself to give you more confidence when you're up there giving a presentation or presenting yourself to the world. Enjoy Geeta Sivanda.
Confidence is a very important aspect that we want to bring forward when we are public. We don't have to be confident in every moment, and we can definitely show our vulnerability, our moments of not being confident. But by being willing to also step into that vulnerability, we open up the door to being confident within that as well. I think acknowledging our authenticity, so they all flow together, those words. Mm-hmm. They're not standalone. They belong together. It's just a way of describing it. But of course, they make up a much bigger full picture. Being able to be authentic and being able to be present will allow for us to be more confident. Mm-hmm. If we try to become somebody else or to be this speaker that we admire so much, we want to be like Tony Robbins or Marianne Williamson.
Shout down women, you mean, and stuff like that?
Yeah.
He's getting in trouble lately for
Yeah, I've
not
had,
respecting the Me Too movement as it's presented to the rest of the world. He thinks it's he's telling women at his big seminars to buck up and quit making excuses. And it's like, not going over well right now in 2018. I could see 5% of your point, but he has a lot of good contributions. But whew, he's taking some heat right now, and that's what the Me Too movement is all about. Like, bring the heat. I love it. Anyway,
yes,
so trying to be someone that you're not, that's the epitome of lack of confidence.
That's exactly where the confidence starts breaking apart, because we cannot be somebody else that we're not. We can have people we admire. We can see leaderships that we want to take on as well, leadership roles. But it all has to happen from within ourselves. We can use the external to feel some energy coming towards us by where we want to go, what we want to become, who we want to become. But it all needs to happen from within. Mm. And so confidence comes within, and being able to step into who we are being and bringing forward more of who we really are will also allow for us to be more confident within that picture.
Being okay with failing or bombing your talk is an example of, I'm okay with that. I don't really care. I'm not attached to the result of whether I'm going to get a standing ovation from the audience or whether they're going to turn and start using their personal devices at the 3/4 mark of my talk.
It's a sign of where you're taking your audience, but it's also a sign of where you're being at right now in that presentation or in that speak, that talk that you're doing. If you want a standing ovation, you need to be okay with not having a standing mm-hmm. ovation. If you want your audience to really bring forward their fullest attention to you, you have to be okay with them not giving you your fullest attention. You have to be attentive to them, and you have to be attentive to yourself. When you are attentive to yourself and to them, then they will also start giving you more attention. Mm. If you are just attentive to the talk that you have prepared or to the paper you have in your hand that you're referring to.
Reading the slides and all the words on them. So people that can't read, all zero of them in the room can get that assistance. Yeah.
Yes. Or the talk that you prepared and rehearsed so much that you're maybe more in your head than you are with yourself and the audience. That is what gets your audience to look at their phone or to chat to the neighbor. If you are really present and you are present with yourself and your audience, it will make your audience listen to you. There's no way around it. Mm-hmm. That's how energy works. When you're bringing your energy out to the people and you're with them and you're feeling the room as a whole, and you're not stuck in your own little bubble, you're not stuck in your own little thoughts of what you think is most important to share, then it becomes an energy exchange. It becomes... Mm-hmm. There's no way around your audience not wanting to listen to you if you're with them. And of course, there are people in the audience that will not like you.
This is
also really normal. There's never going to be an audience that is 100% on your side. I've never, ever seen that happen. You can get a good percentage of the audience on your side, 70, 80%. But there will always be those 10% that totally do not agree with what you're saying. And then there will be the other 10% that completely love you.
Enjoy this clip from Todd White, founder of Dry Farm Wines. They are importers of the cleanest, sugar-free, chemical-free, pristinely grown wine in the old world tradition of non-irrigated grapes. So they come exclusively from Europe. They import them into America to provide to health conscious consumers, especially those in the low carb ketogenic scene, because it's very rare to find wines that are free from sugar and other additives, an amazing array of chemical additives. When you listen to the entire show, you're never going to drink normal wine again. It's a very good education on what's going on there, the commercialism and the impure influences in most of the wine that you're drinking. Yes, even the expensive bottles. So let's listen to Todd with a little teaser of what it's all about to drink a naturally produced wine. Enjoy. So this is, we'll get to this testing now because we're here.
Yeah, we're here.
Which is the biggest deal, because this is where you distinguish yourself from other wine distributors, is you're having these exacting standards that you're voluntarily doing this independent from the wine provider.
We are. So we use a certified oenologist here in Napa. We have one in Italy and one in France who does independent lab testing for us on a whole series of tests, looking for all kinds of toxins and chemicals and also sugar and alcohol. So sugar is because I'm ketogenic and we're anti-sugar and we live a sugar-free lifestyle, sugar is a really, really important thing for us. Sugar can hide in wine and you can't even taste it. Even as professionals, we can't taste sugar at low levels because it hides in acidity. So if the acid is high enough, you can't taste the sugar. So the only way we can confirm that the wine is sugar-free is to lab test it. Sugars in wine, categorically, can range from 0 grams to as high as 300 grams per liter.
Oh, come on.
Coca-Cola, to give you a reference point, Coca-Cola is 108 grams per liter. Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk about these super high sugared wines, we're not...
300 grams per liter.
Right.
What's a wine bottle?
A wine bottle is 750 milliliters.
So a bottle and a quarter of wine.
Right. So a liter is
300 grams of sugar.
Yeah, but I don't want to mislead anybody on this. The 300 gram thing is for like ice wines or dessert wines or like wines that are intentionally very, very, very sweet.
Hangover wines.
Yeah. Well, for commercial wines that you see in your store, they're going to generally range from 7 or 8 to maybe as much as 50 grams per liter.
But we don't know.
You don't know.
Can't hardly taste.
You don't know, because it's just like in Coke. So in Coca-Cola, you've got about 32 grams in a can of Coke. Well, if you were to drink 12 ounces of water with 32 grams of sugar in it, you could barely put it down. It'd be so strickening sweet. But what happens is there's ascorbic acid and other acids that allow them to put this high degree of addictive sugar into the can, right? But then they suppress the sweetness with acid. Just like in a lemonade. If you make lemonade and you put a little sugar in it, it's going to continue to be sour. Mm. You got to put a lot of sugar in it before it starts to taste sweet, right? Because the acid covers the sugar. Well, the same thing happens in wine. And here's how sugars get in wine. Remember earlier we talked about the fermentation process where the yeast eats the sugar. And in our wines, if the yeast is allowed to eat all of the sugar, it's fully fermented, the yeast will die. What's happening in commercial wines is that the winemaker is pouring sulfur dioxide in the wine to kill the yeast prior to a complete fermentation. And they do that to leave sugar behind. Sugar also gives wine mouthfeel, and sugar also gives wine, you know, viscosity in the mouth. So it, you know, it gives us this mouthfeel. And you know when you get that long finish in a wine? Oh, that beautiful long caramelly finish, that's sugar. Mm-hmm. Right? And so you'll notice when you drink our wines, and I expect that we'll drink some tonight, that you don't have any of this long finish. It just evaporates. It's just gone because there's no sugar in it. And it's very sheer and clean. And our audience of clean eaters appreciate this taste.
What about an average wine connoisseur who might not have any dietary consciousness, just an ordinary restaurant critic or something? Are they going to notice a distinct difference between a cleanly produced wine without the chemicals, additives, and sugars?
For sure.
For sure.
For sure. For sure. And most of them will not care for our wines.
Oh, wow.
Because it's like eating bland food
if you're a sugar freak.
It's the difference between drinking, you know, a regular soda or, you know, one of these lightly fruit enhanced waters. You know, I don't know what they call them, but you know what I'm talking about. They have like just an essence of fruit in them, but they're sugar free.
Yeah.
You can just taste an essence of fruit. I forget the brand name, but they're quite delicious. They don't have any carbohydrate, no sugar. They've just got a hint of natural fruit flavoring without enough to impart any sugar. and it's actually clean water. Well, your cola drinker won't like that, right? Because it doesn't give them enough body. It doesn't give them enough communication. Again, remember, we're talking about the difference between a clean palate, a palate that's alive, a palate that's that tastes and can feel, right? Versus a palate that's been killed and deadened by years of abuse from processed food and sugar. And you know, it takes so much to get that palate alive, you know, because it's been killed. It's the dead palate.
Thank you for listening to the show. We would love your feedback at getoveryourselfpodcast@gmail.com. And we would also love if you could leave a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. I know it's a hassle. You have to go to desktop iTunes, click on the tab that says ratings and reviews, and then click to rate the show anywhere from 5 to 5 stars. And it really helps spread the word so more people can find the show and get over themselves, because they need to. Thanks for doing it.